the corporate culture in America has to be do the right thing. At the banks, it has to be do the right thing. And the culture has to change. And, you know, I believe if you help people do the right thing, the money will come along with it. But unfortunately, we have this culture out there that does not think that way. And that's very dangerous to our national security. And this is not only going on, by the way, in banking. This is going on in our politics now. It's going on in government. It's going on across industries. People are looking the other way, and that has to stop. People have to look the right way and open their mouth about it.
Hi, I'm John Kiriakou, and welcome back to Deep Focus. Before we begin, I want to thank you for your support for the show. We are growing by leaps and bounds, and it's only because of you. So I would humbly ask if you continue to like, share, subscribe, and tell your friends and family about the show. We'll continue to grow, but again, it's only thanks to you. There are very few things that I love in media more than a good whistleblower story. Remember, and I say this as a mantra, there's a legal definition of whistleblowing. It is bringing to light any evidence of waste, fraud, abuse, illegality, or threats to the public health or public safety. There are a lot of whistleblowers in the international banking industry. My good friend Brad Birkenfeld is in the Guinness Book of World Records for getting the biggest whistleblower reward in world history when he brought down income tax evasion and money laundering at UBS in Geneva. Well, today's whistleblower is at least as important as Brad Birkenfeld. Everett Stern. Everett Stern was a senior official at HSBC in Delaware. And boy, does he have a story to tell. It involves money laundering. It involves illegal transactions. It involves offshore accounts. And it involves even terrorism. But I'm going to let him tell that story. Everett, welcome to the show. So glad to have you.
Oh, John, it's an absolute honor to be on. Thank you so much for having me.
The pleasure is all mine. Everett, man, it takes some guts to blow the whistle on a banking scandal right here in the United States because you didn't have protection. Let's say, you know, it's one thing to make an accusation against a foreign bank. It's an entirely different thing to make an accusation against a bank that's based here in the United States, in this case in Delaware. So you exposed money laundering at one of the world's largest banks. And since then, you've worked to help other whistleblowers. So tell us what about this case, which began as a tax fraud case, what about this case caught your eye, given your expertise following sort of financial trails? How did this come to your attention?
Yeah, so I was an anti-money laundering compliance officer at HSBC Bank. And when I was there, you know, 3 weeks in on the job, and Netflix did a great series on what I did called Dirty Money. Last week tonight on John Oliver, he did a great, we appreciate what John did. I did a great feature explaining what happened at HSBC Bank. And also, making credit to Rolling Stone magazine. Matt Taibbi did an amazing story on what I did back in 2013 called Gangster Bankers. But I was an anti-money laundering compliance officer there. And what I saw was very serious money laundering. They were intentionally, and this was not just, you know, by accident. I mean, they were intentionally trying to get money to terrorists and drug cartels. And this was very serious, especially on the terrorist front, specifically Hezbollah. You know, that money was going towards the IEDs to blow up our troops. And, you know, I had a choice to either be quiet about it or try to stop it. And that's what I tried to do. And honestly, I risked my life to do it for national security and to protect the United States and our interests. It was very serious. My whole career was destroyed. I ended up, after an HSBC scandal, working at P.F. Chang's as a waiter. I went from working at a Chinese bank to a Chinese restaurant. So it was definitely, you know, I had nothing. And that's when I started my own private intelligence agency, Tactical Rabbit. You know, later on, Stern Cybersecurity. But yeah, it's been a rough road since then. But yeah, circumventing back to the actual scandal itself. I mean, these bankers, John, these guys were terrorists themselves. I mean, and I think the big part of the story is, you know, there was a $1.92 billion fine against HSBC Bank, which is the largest in U.S. history, but nobody went to jail. And that was the biggest, you know, problem for me mentally, was that there were no consequences to this. I mean, that $1.92 billion fine was 5 weeks of their profit. It's nothing. They didn't care, John. This was a cost of doing business to them, and it's still going on. This is not like an isolated incident. This is still going on in other banks. TD Bank just got busted for similar actions. It's disgusting, and it's a national security risk because, you know, look, terrorists and drug cartels, they need money to operate. If you cut off that money supply, we'll win the war. It's the easiest thing to do. Just cut off the money supply. And what our government needs to do is shut down these banks that are financing terrorism and drug cartels.
That's really what it comes down to. And this is something I actually wanted to focus on with you. It's not like you blew the whistle on a couple of, you know, fat cats in expensive suits. You blew the whistle on terrorist financiers and drug cartels. So first, I want to ask you, what entered your mind when you first reviewed this documentation outlining an alleged fraud? What made you think, oh, this is illegal and I'm going to do something about it?
Yeah. So when I was at HSBC Bank, you know, they put me in charge of Middle Eastern transactions. The biggest thing was, John, was they hired me because I didn't know what I was doing. When I was at a business school, I didn't know anything about money laundering. I didn't know anything. I knew somewhat about finance, but I'm not this money laundering expert back then. You know, they hired me because I didn't know what I was doing. For them to put me in charge of Middle Eastern transactions is insane. But what they wanted to do was to get people to just approve transactions all day long and get that money to wire to bad sanctioned entities. Talking sanctioned entities here. So, you know, OFAC puts out a list, the OFAC sanctions list of people and businesses we can't do business with. And these people were manipulating code in the wire filter. That's what I saw. HSBC Bank was criminally manipulating code, and they admitted to this to the U.S. Senate later on. And they were intentionally allowing money to get the terrorists and drug cartels through these wires. So when I was there, I saw this happening, I went to my bosses first. I went to my supervisors, and then I realized they were in on it, and they would not stop the transactions. And that's when I, you know, 3 weeks in, I went to the CIA and started passing information to them. Later, I went to the FBI. I didn't know anything about whistleblowing or anything back then. I didn't even know what a whistleblower was. I just saw there was a national security threat, and I had to do something because people were dying, and more people were going to get killed as a result of this terrorist and drug cartel financing. So, and honestly, John, I didn't think, you know, I'll never forget. I mean, when I did this, I mean, I was passing information to the CIA and FBI. I mean, I was there. I was at HSBC Bank for over a year and a half doing this. You know, I didn't think I was going to live past 30. I mean, I was 26 at the time. Yeah. I mean, I was a young guy out of business school. I thought I was going to get killed. Yeah. And, you know, I viewed it, though, as a self-sacrificial way to do the right thing and to make a difference. And, you know, it was hard. Look, I'm not going to bullshit you here. I mean, this was a very difficult decision I had to make, and I did it for the greater good.
I know exactly what you went through. And whistleblowers sometimes do die because of their whistleblowing. I mean, just look at the Panama Papers whistleblower. The journalist herself was blown up in a car bomb attack in Malta, and nobody's ever been brought to justice. You're 26 years old. You're just a kid wanting to do the right thing, wanting to do the right thing that you were taught to do, right? You're an anti-money laundering compliance officer. So you're supposed to be fighting money laundering, not supporting your employer's money laundering. And as I said, to make it worse, they're doing it for drug cartels and terrorist organizations. I just don't, you know, it's funny to me. It's always struck me as funny that these big organizations, banks, conglomerates, the CIA or whatever, they just assume that everybody is happy being crooked or will support an ongoing criminal conspiracy. Not thinking that, no, normal people are going to object to something like this and they're going to go public with it. And if you can't get satisfaction by going to the authorities, the only place to go is the media. What was the chain of events? When you decided to blow the whistle, where did you go first?
So I first went to the CIA. And the reason for that was, so I always wanted to be in the CIA, actually. That was my dream. And I was a candidate for clandestine service, actually. I was rejected from the CIA, and you know, I never worked for them, or anything, but that was my dream. And you know, it was interesting because my boss at HSBC was a former counterintelligence FBI agent. So I was really concerned, and I was like, well, wait a minute, maybe the I didn't know. I mean, I'm 26 years old, and thinking maybe there's a compromise here. I don't know. My first thought was that, look, these are terrorists getting money. I need to go to the CIA, and I wrote this whole email to my former recruiter, and that email is public now. You know, and that was I was 3 weeks in on my job. It was 2 a.m. I wrote the email. I couldn't sleep at night. I was thinking to myself, what do I do? I mean, I can't go along with this. And then the next chain of events was I went to the FBI, and then I'll never forget that Senate hearing started, and you know, they admitted to financed terrorism drug cartels, and they just got fined. But before that, though, I did go to the media. I went to Reuters, actually, because Reuters was on the story, and I read a story that that a reporter did at a Reuters about HSBC and what was going on in the Newcastle, Delaware office. And there was some of it that was, they didn't have the full picture. And I was like, wait a minute, let me call this reporter and give him the real deal of what's going on. And that's when it went. So this Reuters first broke the story, then Rolling Stone picked it up, and then it just snowballed from there. And then, you know, Netflix did a movie about it years later. And, you know, but that was the chain of events. I'll never forget sitting in this. I lost everything, John. I mean, you have to remember, this was my first job at a business school. I think I was making $5,000 a year, which was a lot of money at the time to me. I mean, it's all I had. And, you know, I ended up living in this, lost everything. I had to sell my car. I had to get rid of my apartment. I ended up living in this 300 square foot apartment in Norristown, Pennsylvania, actually. And I had a camping cot I had to buy at Walmart. It was my bed. I couldn't even afford a bed. So, you know, and I'll never forget, I was getting a lot of publicity, and I was in Rolling Stone. I was getting all this media, but I was broke. Like, I had nothing, and nobody would give me a job except for P.F. Chang's. So if anyone's out there listening to this and you're hungry, go eat at P.F. Chang's for lunch.
Shout out to P.F. Chang's.
Yeah, a huge shout out, because, you know, look, I went to P.F. Chang's with the Rolling Stone article, and I said, look, I did the right thing. I don't know how to wait tables. I'll stay late. I'll learn how to hold the trays. Just please give me a chance. I need to make money. And I'll never forget this manager. He said, you know what? You did the right thing. We'll give you a job. And I started making $2.15 an hour plus tips. And it was that money that where I founded my company, Tactical Rabbit, which I turned into a, you know, very large company later on, you know, but it was, you know, I had, John, I mean, when I had nothing, I'm telling you, I had nothing. And I mean, I'll never forget P.F. Chang's giving me a lo mein to take home to eat. I had no food. You know, my parents, you know, my dad had cancer at the time, and I couldn't, they tried helping me as much as they could, but I couldn't borrow any more money from them. But it all worked out. The good guys do win in the end. I truly believe that. But yeah, there were very serious consequences to what I did, plus threats on my life. But you know what, John, if I get killed over doing the right thing, in my mentality, it's worth it. I don't care. People will remember me, hopefully, for the right things that I did. And I'm not perfect by any stretch of the imagination. I've made mistakes, of course, but, you know, but I try my best. And I think, you know, what bothers me, though, to this day, is it's still going on and no one's doing anything about it. And, you know, there's a lot of people out there turning the other way, John, and they're saying, you know what, I don't want to open my mouth. I don't want to say anything. And you know what, as you know, evil prevails when good men do nothing, right? They look the other way. I think it was Einstein that said that, you know, but it's definitely, that has to stop. The corporate culture in America has to be do the right thing. At the banks, it has to be do the right thing. And the culture has to change. And, you know, I believe if you help people do the right thing, the money will come along with it. But unfortunately, we have this culture out there that does not think that way. And that's very dangerous to our national security. And this is not only going on, by the way, in banking. This is going on in our politics now. It's going on in government. It's going on across industries. People are looking the other way, and that has to stop. People have to look the right way and open their mouth about it.
Before we go on, I want to bring you a word from our sponsors. In recent weeks, Donald Trump has nominated Kevin Warsh to lead the Federal Reserve. Most people saw that headline and just moved on. But there's something here that's worth paying attention to. Warsh has openly supported developing a U.S. central bank digital currency. That's a system where your dollars exist as programmable code instead of physical cash. I spent 15 years at the CIA. I know how surveillance infrastructure works, and I know that capabilities built for one purpose rarely stay limited to that purpose. A digital dollar has the potential to let the government track every transaction you make, freeze your account without a court order, restrict what you can and can't purchase, automatically deduct fines or taxes, even put expiration dates on your own savings. I'm not saying that's the plan. I'm saying that's the capability. And once that infrastructure exists, history shows that it gets used. That's why I've partnered with American Alternative Assets to bring you a free report called The Digital Dollar Trap. It breaks down what's being built, who's behind it, and how physical gold could help protect your savings from a system designed for control. So go to johnlovesgold.com to download your free copy of the report, or call 1-888-GOLD-053 to request one by mail. That is johnlovesgold.com or 888-GOLD-053. Everett, how did this experience of whistleblowing, especially blowing the whistle in this major international financial concern called HSBC, how did that inform the way you evaluated risk and credibility? What I mean to say here is the question at its most basic form. Weren't you scared? You said a moment ago that you were willing to go down in history sort of as a martyr. I had exactly the same feeling. And once I blew the whistle, the more I got past, you know, the original revelation, the more I was willing to just scrap for a fight. Did you go through that same kind of period where you just came to the decision that you're the only person talking about this kind of thing? The American people are owed the truth. And if you're going to be the only person telling the truth, then by God, that's just the way it has to be. What was your calculation?
Yeah, no, John, you hit the nail on the head. I mean, I made a decision in my mind that I was dead. That's what it came down to, honestly. I thought eventually on my timeline, it's going to end. Whether it's 40 years from now or 100 years from now or tomorrow, I'm going to die either way, right? But yeah. I felt though I was going to die much sooner due to what I was doing. So yeah, I was going to go down as a martyr, and I just needed to tell the truth. It doesn't matter what people think, you know. For a while there, I did care what people think, and it bothered me a lot. And even now, I look at trolls on social media every once in a while, and it gets to me. But overall, though, you can't care what people think. You just have to speak the truth, and that's it. And it's amazing to me how the bad guys will fight back, though. You know, they will create a counter narrative to try to destroy you and destroy your credibility and cause you harm. And it's a fight. I mean, it is not easy, because these bad guys, they fight back. And you have to be willing to go the distance, get knocked down. But again, the key thing here, and this goes across all facets of life, you get knocked down, you better get the F back up. That's what has to happen. You have to keep getting up and keep fighting for that truth, what you know is right. And if you're out there listening to this, if you know you're in the same boat, you have to keep going. That's my message to people. Keep going, keep fighting, keep getting that truth out there. And the difference will get made. You know, you can't, you can only control what you can control, right? And that's it. So, but yeah, I've been in a lot of situations where, you know, my job overall is to, and not beyond HSBC, is to tell the truth. When I was running in politics, my job was to get the truth out there. And look, I had a lot of people throughout not only HSBC, but in other circumstances I was in politics or whatnot, I had people leave my side and all my friends go away and people turn on me and different. But you have to be able to suffer those consequences, because that's just what comes, for some reason, that's what God does. He just wants you to there's a consequence to doing the right thing. If it was easy, everyone would be doing it, right? So for some reason, there's this mechanics out there where if you do the right thing, there's a lot of pushback. And again, that's where it comes down to culture, where that culture has to change. Because, you know, for right now, if you're out there telling the truth and you're going up against either a large bank or, you know, another, whatever you're going up against, I'm telling you, there's going to be you're up against an army. And whether it's a small army or a big one, it's an army, and you have to be willing to fight. And that, again, this is not just in whistleblowing, all aspects of life. You have to keep going, John. I mean, that's the name of the game.
That leads to my next question. You know, one of the things that I struggled with early on in my own whistleblowing is we're all taught, all of us, whether you're in government or outside government, we're all taught to go through the chain of command. Well, my chain of command created the torture program. I couldn't go to the general counsel because the general counsel had approved of the torture program. I couldn't go to the inspector general because he wasn't read into the compartment and he didn't know what the heck I was talking about. I couldn't go to the congressional oversight committees because they had approved of and funded the torture program. So the only place I could go was the media, and I paid for it with 23 months in a federal prison. Brad Birkenfeld couldn't go through his chain of command because his chain of command was laundering the money and evading the taxes. So he did exactly what he was supposed to do. He went to the Treasury Department, to the Office of Investigations, and they loved his information and they referred him to the FBI. And then after the FBI sucked all the information out of him, they arrested him and they charged him with a crime. They didn't charge the big bankers in Geneva with any crime, but they charged Brad. Now, Brad was fortunate in that while he was in prison, his attorneys sued the Treasury Department for a whistleblower reward. And Brad was finally awarded $104 million when he got out of prison. So my question is, what was it like making the decision on where to go to blow the whistle? You had a lack of IRS interest, for example. The state bureaus weren't interested. And Delaware is notorious for its disinterest in illegality on the part of banks. How did you decide where to go? And why didn't you get the big payout once this case was all done?
Yeah, so I had to go to the media. The media is number one. And the cases, when people come to me with cases, because attached rabbit, people come to me whistleblowing cases and different fraud situations, and I have to bring it either. A lot of times I try to report it to the USG, to the FBI, or to proper regulatory agencies in different whistleblowing cases or even my own. But sometimes government doesn't listen. And you just have to go to the media, the press. And this is why, you know, I have a real problem with what's going on in today's political environment. The press is being hammered right now. And that's not good because there can't be restrictions on media. It has to be free speech where the reporters can get out the truth without fear. That's very important. But anyways, you know, in me, going to the media is critical because they can get out the truth and get it out to the masses. But look, I ran into a huge problem with ABC News. I mean, I got interviewed by Brian Ross and they killed the story. So there's also catch and kill out there, right? There's a whole nother game to be played with when it comes down to media as well. There are some report. I'm not, you know, criticizing Brian Ross or anything, but I'm just saying that it wasn't right what they did to me, but ABC News, they shut down the HSBC story. There's catch and kill. And that's a real thing out there. But why I didn't get, you know, a huge payout in this case. I mean, look, my lawyers submitted, it was a huge fight. Some of it's, you know, confidential as to why I didn't get that, you know, a huge payout, but look, it doesn't matter. The money was never a goal of mine at all.
Yeah, right.
Like, it wasn't on radar. Again, sure. I didn't know about whistleblowing programs. And I think that was also a big thing. I filed a TCR complaint with the SEC much later. I mean, I didn't know about whistleblowers or anything like that. And I just knew that there was a national security risk. Terrorists and drug cartels were getting money and I had to stop it. That was it. So, and I had to use the media to do it. Yeah, I think though right now, just in general, I think we're in dangerous territory overall, because I think those media restrictions are becoming very apparent, and it's risky because whistleblowers are going to have a harder time, even in government right now. I mean, people are really in fear about coming forward, and that's not a good thing.
You know, let's contextualize that too, because I think that's very important, Everett. I've known Brian Ross. I blew the whistle to Brian Ross. Brian Ross that gave me, you know, the top story on ABC World News Tonight and Nightline and Good Morning America the next day. It was to Brian that I spilled. But you're right. We've got now no investigative function left at the Washington Post, a severely curtailed investigative function at the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. None of the broadcast news networks are able to do investigative journalism. And so when Everett Stern calls and says, I have evidence of wrongdoing, I want to blow the whistle, and there's no staff to investigate your allegations, and then HSBC says, oh, don't pay any attention to him, he's just a crazy person, then the story's killed. The story's killed. The American people have been ripped off. You've had your reputation eviscerated, and you end up at P.F. Chang's. I'll tell you the truth. Just 2 weeks after I blew the whistle, my wife and I were sitting at the kitchen table, and she was doing her things on a calculator. And she said to me, I'm not sure how we're going to buy food next week. And I said, are we already in that bad a shape? And she said, yeah, we don't have money for food. And the next day we went to the welfare office and we qualified for everything. That's how bad it gets. And that's how quickly it gets bad. So certainly you knew that you were up against a Goliath. What was it that motivated you to then continue forward, even when these official channels appeared to be closed?
The greater good.
Yeah.
I mean, it's as simple as that. I had to self-sacrifice for the greater good. The United States, I had to do it. This was my look. I got rejected from the CIA, which was devastating, but this was my chance to serve and to do something good. This was my chance. God gave it to me. For some reason, it put me in this place at this time. I had to perform and do what I needed to do to protect the United States, to protect our citizens. I mean, 9/11 was not that far off. I mean, you know, again, you know, terrorists and drug cartels need money to operate, and they're killing us out there, and they're using it with our own money to do it. And I had to stop that. And my biggest failure in life, I honestly hold myself accountable for this, is not those bankers not going to jail. I feel I'm responsible for that. I really do. I feel the HSBC thing, you know, people say, oh, I've had people tell me I'm a hero and this and that. No, I do not feel that way, John, at all. I feel like I failed in that case because I did not get anyone in jail. The banking charter was not revoked. I mean, yeah, I made a lot of noise and exposed everything. But honestly, John, I'm still fighting to this day to make that difference because I don't feel I made it.
You made it. I guarantee you that you made it. You may not think so, but what you're describing is probably the most common emotion that goes through every whistleblower. First of all, most whistleblowers either have no idea that they're whistleblowers or just adamantly deny that they're whistleblowers. The morning that I met with attorneys at the Government Accountability Project, I was there for 3 hours, and I was walking out. I said, I want to really thank you for taking my case. I know that you only represent whistleblowers, and I'm not a whistleblower. And Jesslyn Radak said, you're a whistleblower. And I said, no, I'm not. I'm just a normal guy who just said something. And she said, you're the poster boy for whistleblowers. And that's when she told me about this legal definition of bringing to light evidence of waste, fraud, abuse, illegality, or threats to the public health or public safety. So you may not think that you've had an impact. I'm telling you, man, you've had an impact. It's just going to take a little bit of time for you to see it. And with that, I need to take another break. So why do most people wait until they're sick to think about medication? That just doesn't make any sense to me. When someone in your house wakes up feeling awful, that's the worst time to realize that you don't know what you have and what you need. Now you're scrambling, you're calling your doctor, you're waiting for an appointment, you're standing in a pharmacy line surrounded by sick people, hoping that they even have what you need in stock. Well, that's backwards. Smart families think ahead. That's why it's important to have a pharmacy that can send medication in advance, so you already have it on hand when you need it. Not in a panic, not last minute. All Family Pharmacy lets you do exactly that. You go online, you choose your medications, fill out a quick medical form, and a licensed doctor reviews your request and provides the prescription if it's appropriate for you. Then they ship it directly to your door. You can stock up on essentials like antibiotics, Z-Packs, antivirals, ivermectin, mebendazole, Tamiflu, NAD+, and more than 300 other prescription medications to choose from. So go to allfamilypharmacy.com/John and use the code JOHN10, J-O-H-N-1-0, to save 10% on your order today. Again, that is allfamilypharmacy.com/John, and the code is JOHN10. Everett, one last question for you. It's a substantive one. And this is something that I struggled with for years after I blew the whistle on the torture program. What, in your opinion, should we be thinking about in terms of reforms or oversight that would help prevent the kind of neglect, the kind of false reporting that you told us about in this case, and protect future whistleblowers? After all, we've got a Federal Whistleblower Protection Act that nobody seems to pay any attention to. So what kind of reforms or oversight are most important right now?
Yeah, so I think that's a great question. I mean, I think the biggest reform is that there has to be a culture change, John. Like, it's not just the government can put out as many programs as they want. It's not going to make, I don't think, that big of a difference, because again, a lot of people are not motivated by money. And I think what the big deterrent for whistleblowers are the very serious consequences that come with blowing the whistle. And if we can help take away those consequences where people say, you know what, let's reward someone from doing the right thing, not just monetarily, but help, you know, letting them feel like a human being or not destroying their credibility and that culture has to change. And let me just say, you know, I'm a board member of Whistleblowers of America, which is a tremendous organization. And Jackie Garrick does an amazing job there. And what
she does,
she focuses on is, you know, helping people with mental health, you know, getting through whistleblowing crisis. And what she does, and that Whistleblowers of America, is just amazing. And I wish that organization existed when I was going through what I went through, because I could have used that emotional and mental support and that you know, that camaraderie amongst whistleblowers, where you can talk to other people. That's huge. That support, right, is very important. And when I blew the whistle, that just didn't exist. Yes. And, you know, I remember, it's a funny story, I remember going to, you know, talk to a therapist, because I was getting really depressed, to be honest with you. I was getting very depressed. And, you know, I'll never forget. I went to this therapist, and he thought I was, he's like, you know what? I don't believe, I was telling him about terrorists and drug cartels and all this stuff. And he's like, Everett, I think, you know, you might be a crazy person or something. Like, this doesn't make sense. And I was like, no. I was like, you got to look me up. And then he ended up looking me up. He read the Rolling Stone article and he called me up and apologized, because he knew I was telling the truth. But mm-hmm. Out of context, these stories, people will think, automatically will go to, you're crazy. And that will be used against whistleblowers till the end of time, to destroy someone's credibility. And that just can't happen. That this culture has to change in this world, John. You know, cause it's not right or fair for someone to suffer for doing the right thing. I think justice, you know, in the justice system out there, you know, one thing I've learned, John, it's just a system. There's no justice. It's just a system. And that has to change. And there's so much that has to change. And that's why, you know, it's interesting, because when I ran for public office, I really wanted to make that difference and get in there and do something good. And I realized very quickly that the system is just not aligned for that. It's just not. It's aligned.
That's exactly right.
Down. And it's aligned to not to have the right thing be done, I think. And I was very naive getting into politics, very naive and stupid. But, you know, I realized, there's a huge problem out there in that the system. But I do believe, though, the system has to be changed from the inside. So I do believe that, you know, you can put pressure on an outside structure, But the real change has to come from within. And I think once the American people, you know, realize that the culture has to change, I'm talking in a bipartisan way here. I'm not talking one party or another. I'm just saying when people get into office and they start really caring, and that's when you're going to start seeing changes in our environment, our culture. That's all I'll say. I'll leave it with that. It's just saying that when people sincerely care and this apathy in this country goes away and around the world, you know, and I think that's the biggest thing is people, there's just apathy out there. And that for some reason is a cool thing. And it's not a cool thing. You have to care. You have to fight to make a difference. And all I'll say is the people out there who are suffering because they're fighting the good fight, keep up that good fight. We have to stick together. There's no other option because if we turn away or stop fighting, evil will prevail. And we've seen what happens time and time again when people look away, evil will prevail. And we cannot under any circumstance let that happen.
If some situations really are just black and white, right and wrong. And so be on the side of right. It's as simple as that. Sure, the cost is high. Believe me, like you, Everett, I lost literally everything. I lost my freedom, my pension, my family, my home. I lost everything, my reputation, everything. But in the end, the country has come around to my way of thinking. My way, your way. And so doing the right thing is always the right thing to do. I know that sounds like a cliche, but it's true. So you've dabbled in politics. You've contributed to the success of Whistleblowers of America. Jackie does fantastic work there. What's next for you then?
You know, what's next for me is I have a 9-month-old baby at home, which is wonderful. Amazing. Yeah, I got married, I have a beautiful wife. I have two loving kids. Great. It's just amazing. And for me is to make sure that my sons grow up and my baby grows up to live in a world that's better than what we have now. And that's, it's just to make that little bit of a difference. You know, Emerson put out that success poem. And in that poem, he's saying, if you can just make a small difference, you know, leave the world just a little bit better with a garden patch or a redeemed social condition, just something little. Right. That's what's next for me. It's just one little baby step forward in doing the right thing and trying to leave this world a little better. That's my goal, John. And how exactly I do that is simply by just doing what's the next right thing of what's in front of me. That's all I can do.
Mm-hmm. And Everett, where can people learn more about the work that you're doing?
Yeah, so it's everettstern.com. I have my Twitter, everettstern1, on X, I guess now it's called. And then there's Tactical Rabbit and Stern Cybersecurity that I have. But if you Google Everett Stern, you'll see. I don't say that in arrogance. I come right up. You know, I'm very, very grateful for the media and people that have posted things about me. It's very nice of them. They can learn more about what I'm doing. And however I can support other people out there trying to do the right thing, believe me, I will do whatever it takes to help advance the mission. And that mission is just doing the next right thing.
That's it. That's it right there. Everett Stern, thanks so much for joining us. Good to see you.
It's an honor, sir. Thank you.
Thank you. Pleasure's all mine. Thank you, man.